As you know, my name is Dan Lyons, and I represent Jane Doe in this matter. Central to this case is the decision of this court back in 1962, Draper versus Olivier. The parties have spent a great deal of time addressing Olivier, but I think what I would Draper, I'm sorry, but what I'd like to do is talk about the court's decision below to start with. And I would suggest respectfully that the court's decision below really got it wrong. And really what it did was, what the court did was, it stood Draper on its head insofar as we focused on who had to prove what. The court below, Judge Abelman, seemed to think or seemed to say that it was up to the plaintiff to prove that the conduct complained of was expectable. That's not what Draper said. Draper said there's an affirmative defense which said that to get off the hook, a defendant must prove that certain conduct was entirely unexpectable. And the last time we were here, I talked about the fact that I get confused on these double negatives. The court below said that the behavior must be, I'm looking at my own notes here, frequently manifested. In other words, we would have to prove that this happened frequently. That's not what the test is under Draper. The test under Draper is, again, affirmative defense, entirely unexpectable. Can be rare, but to defend, entirely unexpectable. The court below talked about the fact that the plaintiff wanted to invoke a presumption that the state police routinely or not rarely engaged in sexual misconduct. That's not what Draper says. It's not up to us to prove that, and that's not part of this. The court below talked about the fact that the behavior alleged was so outrageous that we could never prevail as a matter of law, even at the summary judgment stage. That's not what the rule is. Outrageous behavior can, in fact, fall within the permissible plaintiff's case under Draper. In fact, in Draper, the facts were that the fellow who was the employee of the defendant slashed the throat of someone with a can opener. And I believe the court in Draper referred to this as outrageous behavior, which of course it was. Nonetheless, the court said that as long as that behavior was not unexpectable, see if I got that right, again, defendant to prove that it was unexpectable, as long as it was not unexpectable, even outrageous behavior can go forward, even intentional behavior can go forward.
So, Mr. Lyons, based on your reading of Draper and the law, as you interpret Draper, what exactly is the burden that the plaintiff must carry?
I was thinking about this on the way down, and it occurred to me, there's that four-point checklist that shows up in the Draper opinion and actually was set out in Judge Abelman's opinion. And it occurred to me, I don't know why I didn't think of this before, really that you've got to prove, may I look at my notes? You've got to prove, the plaintiff has to prove three things to carry its burden, at least at this stage. It must show that the activity is of the kind the employee is employed to perform. It must show that the activity falls within the authorized time and space limits. And it must show that the activity is activated, in part at least, by a purpose to save the master. Now, I must say, as I read Draper, applying those tests to the Draper facts, the court in Draper said it looked at activity in a general sense, did not look at the specific tortious act that had been alleged. But they said, for example, this fellow whose name was Willie was employed to direct traffic. They said that he was doing it at the time all this happened. They said that this course of behavior was activated at least in part by a purpose to serve the master. If that is proven, it seems to me, and if the force were to, because they talked about force, were to fall within that scope, then there's a problem for the defense. That's when we kick in the affirmative defense. So that I suggest that you look generally, you tick off the Draper factors, 1 through 3. Once you fall within them, you're okay.
The third one is what?
Third one is it is activated in part at least by a purpose to serve the master. This is laid out specifically in Draper and specifically in Judge Abelman's opinion. And so I hadn't really thought of it this way, but as soon as you start to think about unexpectability, you say to yourself, well, and Draper said that, this is an affirmative defense. And so that's when the burden would shift, I believe, to the defendant.
Is foreseeability an appropriate substitute word for expectability?
Probably foreseeability.
Well, then is it foreseeable in the sense of really likely to happen, or is it foreseeable in the sense that anything can happen?
It's certainly not foreseeable in the sense that it's likely to happen. And I believe that the law does not say, well, anything can happen. I would suggest to you that a defendant cannot say the following to kind of address this. I had no idea that could happen. I had no basis to think that could possibly happen. And that's what I would use as the test. I thought about this as well. Foreseeability, usually the plaintiff has to prove in a negligence case. In this case, the non-foreseeability becomes the defendant's burden by way of an affirmative claim. As we pointed out in the briefs, the state made no showing as to unforeseeability here, zero. And Draper said that the burden was placed on the state to do that. Now, we went forward trying to point out where in the record we believe that there is sufficient support if the showing were made by the state, what we would rely upon to say here's a factual dispute. And we talked about wrongful claims or claims of wrongful behavior that had been brought against the state police and other police over the last 25 years, one of which was a claim that a state trooper had engaged in sexual misconduct during the course of an arrest, which, of course, is what we're dealing with here. The state said, well, yeah, but that case got thrown out. It was thrown out because it was time barred. It wasn't thrown out for any other reason. The idea is that this would put you on notice. There was a claim against a police officer from Lewis, and we don't know how that was resolved. It was a claim for sexual misconduct. And we don't know how that resolved, but I had raised the question in discovery, albeit after discovery closed, because that's when it came to my attention. Well, who investigated that? And the last time we were here, I had to say we don't know the answer to that. But now I know the answer because I figured it out. If you look at a statute that the state cited in support of their position that the state police, the duty of the state police, 8302 of Title 11, I believe. If you look at that statute, and it was in support of the state's position that the primary job of the state police is to conserve the peace, that is what part of that statute says. But if you continue reading down, which I did not do in anticipation of our last hearing, it says that the state police have exclusive jurisdiction to investigate all claims of rape in this state. So that as far as the Lewis case was concerned, state police under law would have been investigating that. Another thing Draper said to address this issue.
Before you move to another thing, you mentioned under number 3 of Draper, your conduct has to be furthering the employer's purpose.
I agree.
And so how does that apply to the allegations in your complaint?
As I interpret Draper, at each of those three factors, Draper was looking at the behavior in a general sense, not the specific tortious behavior. because there is a very specific passage in Draper, and I don't have Draper in front of me, but they said, well, let's see how Draper, how what Willie did, who was the defendant employee in this case. And I do remember one of the statements was, well, he was employed to direct traffic. It was undisputed that he did that. It was he was working at a time and place that he was supposed to. It was undisputed that he did that. I don't have the opinion in front of me, but the third factor, and the Supreme Court said, it's undisputed that he did that. And it's obvious they were looking at this with a broad general focus. Then they said, it's only when you get to number four that we have to focus on this, if force is used, we have to focus on this issue of expectability.
Let me see if I understand what you're saying Draper means. Applied to this case, we have, it's the kind of conduct he's employed to perform. If you look at it in terms of arresting someone and taking them to the police station, then it is the type of conduct that he's employed for.
I agree.
Okay. Then number two, it occurs within authorized time and space, and that's also happening because he was on duty, right?
I agree.
And was acting in the capacity as a police officer. So then you get to number three as to whether it was the action was at least in part to serve the master. If I understand your argument, it's along these lines. Obviously, committing a sexual act was not in any way in support of his duties as a police officer.
Correct.
Nobody would suggest that it was. But what you look at instead is, was the conduct of taking somebody and putting them in the police car for the purpose of taking them to be arrested or fingerprinted, whatever, was that in furtherance of the master? And in looked at it in that view, it was.
Yes, Your Honor, that's our position.
So we do not say, well, you know, obviously committing rape is not part of a police officer's job, therefore you fail number three. So all we get to is the last one, which is, was it expectable?
Yeah, or not entirely unexpectable.
Okay.
Or the affirmative defense, entirely unexpectable.
And you get to where you say you are with respect to number three, because in Draper, the person directing traffic cut somebody's throat, and the Draper court didn't focus on parsing number three. What the Draper court focused on is you were furthering the work of the master by directing traffic, and the fact that you cut somebody's throat while you're supposed to be directing traffic is a separate consideration from our inquiry. And
I would
then
agree.
You move to number four.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
In terms of the, just to go back quickly to this issue of what basis is there for expectability that we can make to counter the requirement of an affirmative defense, Draper talked about the fact that there are a number of cases out there where security people or construction people have ended up in disputes with the public. And the court in Draper said, you know, given all these reported decisions, it's hard to see how this sort of behavior is entirely unexpectable.
But isn't a conflict, an altercation, when you're trying to regulate people, expectable, and what happened here simply is not expectable? Isn't there a difference in expectability degree, if nothing else?
I understand the point Your Honor's making. If I can address the sexual side of this, the expectability of the sexual side. Draper said, look at all these cases, and these things happen, unfortunately, meaning violence in the course of, I guess, construction workers or employees dealing with the public. In this case, we listed a number of cases where, unfortunately, the sexual side has taken place. And it is true that there are two lines of cases, and we acknowledge this in the brief. Half of them, or some of them, say, we're going to hold the police officer liable because that is not unexpectable, which I think is pretty important to focus on that, the exact phraseology. And the other half saying we're never going to do it because of either the position the state takes here or the observation that Your Honor made. But the point is those cases are out there. And the issue here is notice. The issue is not, the issue is notice as in there's something out there. So that something stops you from saying, state, this is entirely unexpectable. It happens. It has happened. There have been such allegations. There have been such allegations in this state. But I kind of go back to the original point, which is simply this is an affirmative defense, and they have made absolutely no showing.
Well, I think that your argument does an admirable job of trying to fit some of these pieces together. But at the end of the day, doesn't the rule that you're arguing for create essentially strict liability on the part of the police?
I would say no, for this reason. I thought about this as well. Let's say a police officer's driving home, and he sees somebody he does not like, and he still has a uniform on, he's carrying his gun, all of that is okay. He has the right to take the car home. He stops the car, he walks out, and he shoots the person. Well, there's no liability there. There cannot possibly be any liability there. Because one of the things in Sims, which was the Superior Court case, was that Sims talked about there has to be you have to be there at the time and place, but that's not all. I'm not making an only time and place argument. The misbehavior has to be, and I think they use these words, fairly incidental or incidental to the authorized behavior that was taking place at the time.
Hey, let me follow up on Justice Jacobs' question. How about strict liability when the victim is in the custody of the police officer for the tort committed by the police officer?
I would say you're probably at that point. It's hard for
me
to
argue. If the state police are on the hook for what the state trooper does if the person's in custody.
I would say that you're right. That's a breach of duty. There's a duty of when someone is in custody to take care of the person. That's a breach of duty. And if you look at the state insurance program here, we touched on this in the brief, it covers breach of duty. It covers assaults. For the life of me, I can't figure out why you would cover breach of duty if breach of duty is not in play here.
So another way to look at what you're arguing under 4 is you could have said something to the Superior Court like, you know, there's a cause of action in federal law known as 1983 when police officers and other agents violate people's civil rights in a variety of ways, including assaults. And therefore, that's something that is can be expected because we have this whole body of 1983 action. And if we assume that is something you could say, as I understand your argument, then it's incumbent on the state as the defense to say, yes, we agree, there's all sorts of action that falls under 1983, but this was unexpected. And they raise that as a defense.
That's where we have the argument. It can't be unexpected. The state has been sued for it. There have been claims made in this state. There are cases across the country.
I understand that. But what I'm trying to look at the state of the record. You've got one case where the allegation was made and it was dismissed. We have a second case where involving Lewis where we don't know exactly what transpired. And the state can make a statistical argument that if that's all you have, maybe it's still unexpected because it's so rare. But the purpose of my question was to say there are a lot of 1983 actions where people are engaged in conduct during the course of their official duties that are simply wrong. And if that's enough, and it could be under Draper, for you to say, look, people exceed the bounds of their official duties all the time, we should get to go forward. as I understood your argument, you would embrace this 1983 analogy and then put the burden on the state to show why it was unexpected.
I think, yes, I agree, and I think the burden's on the state without me putting it on them. One of the authorities that we cited was the Restatement of Torts Section 219, and I will say in candor to the court, you may remember this or not, the Chief Justice said to me, are you abandoning 219? And I said yes, and I was mistaken. I should not have said that. In any event...
That's the advantage of rehearing en banc. You start with a clean slate.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because in any event, the state really put it back in play, because they brought to Your Honor's attention a decision from the United States Supreme Court from last week. And it was a federal civil rights Title VII, Civil Rights Act of 1964 action. And in that case, this issue came up. What needs to be shown to reach vicarious liability for the employers of the wrongdoing? And that at the part that the state cited, the court said, look, last time around, or in the last case we decided, because there had been earlier cases, we relied on 219. Now, we know that there's a third restatement now that, in essence, doesn't say the same thing as 219. But the court then said two things. Number one, you fellows haven't argued about walking away from 219. And number two, we think it's a pretty good way to go anyway. So what I'm saying is, as recently as a week ago, there has been that endorsement. I see I'm running out of time, but I would like to touch on...
That brings to mind the old adage that there are three arguments, the one that you're prepared to make, the one you actually made, and the one you wish you made. but seriously, my question is about strict liability. Really are predicated on the thought that if a court is deciding whether or not to recognize or impose tort liability on a party, particularly an employer, at least in part, the reason for doing so is that the employer is in a better position to prevent the harm than the victim.
I agree.
And what concerns me here is that I have no earthly idea of how the police, even on the best of days, could prevent something like this from happening.
I was asked that before, and I said you could have a female officer involved, meaning brought out to the scene every time a female is transported. Someone said, well, we don't have that many female officers. My response is, well, then bring out a male officer. As long as you have two officers, you can be okay. And if someone said, well, we don't necessarily have enough people to do that, then my response is, these police cars are equipped with video cameras. And the newer ones, at any event, look forward and look backward. And there's not going to be any misbehavior if that video is on. And if it's off, then there's got to be a question as to why it was off. To follow up on your issue, because you asked me about policy last time, what good would come of holding in Jane Doe's behavior, that there is this, one could say, an expanded view of the law under Draper. One could say Draper fits it. Or one truly could say, because we talked about Mary M. from California, one could say we're going to adopt Mary M. as an outright exception to the whatever rule we say is the middle-of-the-road rule. But here's why I think it makes sense to not let the police off the hook on this record. think what you have. You have a police officer who, it is alleged, used his powers of arrest to assault someone in the course of an arrest. That almost seems counterintuitive to say that the state won't stand behind them to respond in damages. Second issue is, if the police are required, or the state is required to respond in damages, I believe that fits into a theory of respect for the police. And if there is not a way to respond in damages, people will lose respect for the police. And we encourage prevention. We just talked about that. We make the victim whole. And one last thing. There is a provision of law. I don't have the site in front of me. It is in the brief. And I believe it's a provision that talks about why we have the state insurance program. And in that provision, it's in the brief, in that provision it says it is the policy of this state to protect our citizens from wrongful acts. Well, that's what we have here. And if we don't hold them accountable, we haven't protected them. The state had said before, I got 10 seconds, state last time seemed to say if it's not authorized, it's not covered. And I suggest that cannot possibly be the case because you'd never have respondeat otherwise. That's all I have.
Thank you. Mr. McTaggart, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mike McTaggart, on behalf of the State of Delaware. I want to first mention the case that we sent up to the Court from the United States Supreme Court, which was decided last week. It's our reading of the case that in Vance versus Ball State, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the restatement third of agency had disposed of Section 219 as a cause of action. And embraced the restatement third of agency and also indicated that the restatement third of agency drew some of their prior cases into question. So we cited that to the court as we have cited other cases in our brief that have recognized the restatement third of agency as the standard to use in evaluating scope of employment cases. Some of those cases have been from the Delaware trial court. Some have been from around the country. But we set forth that argument in our brief.
Well, remind us, where does that take us? If we decide to adopt the restatement third of agency, how does that operate with regard to these facts?
You know, the analysis is not much different, but the restatement third of agency is, I think it's a more simplified test. It combines, I believe, 13 sections of the restatement second into one section. It's much easier to follow. It's written in more general terms. The focus is whether or not the employee engaged in some independent course of conduct which was not intended to further the purpose of the employer. We believe that's this case, that this trooper engaged in an independent course of conduct that was not intended to further the purpose of the employer, and the act is not within the scope of employment. The restatement third also moves away from this notion of expectability or unexpectability or foreseeability, and instead focuses on the intent of the employee at the time of the tort, which we believe is the proper analysis to apply in this case. And the facts in this case, the plaintiff testified that she knew she had an outstanding capias. She knew from prior experience that the police officer was required to take her to court. She also testified that she knew when the police officer engaged in this act that it was wrong, that he was breaking the law. She also testified she knew he was arrested because he broke the law. He did something he wasn't supposed to do. We also have the arrest warrant in this case. Unlike in Draper, where the incident took a minute, the arrest warrant in this case lists the time of the offense for 1 hour and 50 minutes. For 1 hour and 50 minutes, this police officer was engaged in some independent course of conduct that had absolutely no purpose to serve the Delaware State Police. We also have a statute which clearly defines the duties of the police officer to protect the public, to investigate crimes. All that laid together, we submit, supports the finding of the trial court that this is not within the scope of employment.
Well, how do you explain Draper? Somebody slashed somebody's throat, right? That certainly wasn't what a person who's directing traffic would be expected to do or would be considered part of that person's job description or what his employer would have expected from him. We're almost by definition, when we've got these kinds of cases, we're talking about somebody who acted in a way that was harmful, that was not part of what that person's basic duties were. So you seem to be saying, well, since clearly, engaging in sexual misconduct is not part of the job duties of a police officer, that's it. You know, he was not engaged in his job and therefore no respondeat superior. But in all of these cases, what we're going to be dealing with is conduct that is not appropriate, that is offensive, that is harmful, which is always going to mean it's conduct that was not part of the job. So how do you get around that?
You know, I think in Draper, there's five different places where the court indicated that despite the fact that this conduct was wrongful or improper, that it was done with some wrong-headed purpose to serve the master. The court made that statement throughout the opinion.
Well, is the court saying that the perpetrator actually thought that he was helping control traffic by slashing somebody's throat? That on its face is pretty ludicrous, right? So I think perhaps what the court was talking about was that the offender was at a construction site. At least when he started out, he was trying to deal with traffic and deal with, you know, people who were not respecting the construction workers' situation. And it is in that respect that the person was, to some extent, acting on behalf of the master. And by the same token, the police officer here was taking somebody to be, you know, arresting somebody and taking that person to the police station. It was not expected that there'd be sexual misconduct, just like it was not expected that somebody's throat's going to be slashed. But that doesn't really get you out of the analysis of whether, in part, the police officer was carrying out his duties.
You know, I think I would view Draper as what's the restatement, section 707 of the restatement third talks about escalation cases, and I would view Draper as an escalation case, an escalation of an argument or a fight that went wrong that was somehow involved in this employee discharging his duties. And I think the court said in Draper that it was a close case and emphasized that it only took a minute from beginning to end. And despite the fact that what the employee did was criminal, viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the driver in that case, the court seemed to say, and I counted it five different times, that the facts could be viewed that somehow this employee was trying to serve the purpose of the employer. And I think in Draper, the court also said that in terms of the limits of vicarious liability, relates to incidents that are more or less certain to occur on the job. Unlike the one-minute incident in Draper, this is a long, drawn-out incident. At some point, this trooper made a decision that he was not going to arrest this woman and that he was going to engage in some sexual act with her. We submit at that point he's not furthering the interests of the employer. In fact, he's doing the exact opposite of what he's supposed to do. I understand the argument from the appellant, which is that if something is possible, then it's within the scope of employment, and we don't believe that's the rule in Draper or the rule that the court should adopt.
But in Draper, also, at some point, the defendant or the employee who was directing traffic made a conscious decision to go slash the throat of the victim, of the plaintiff. So how do you distinguish this case from Draper?
You know, I would go back to the question of whether or not at the time that he was doing that, and I think the court addressed this in Draper, what he did was incidental to his duties of being a security guard. He may have done it the wrong way. He may have done it in a criminal way, but it was basically an escalation of this original scuffle.
But the word incidental is not an analytical tool that helps a court decide a case. Designed to announce a result. So do you have any other basis to distinguish Draper?
Yes, Your Honor. The point that the statement from the court that the employee was intending to further the purpose of the master, at least in some wrong way. We don't have that in this case.
I'm sorry, in Draper, the employee that took a break from his job and slashed the throat of the victim thought he was helping further the purposes of the employer?
Your Honor, I don't think this was a situation in Draper where there was a break. I think this was all something that happened very quickly within a minute.
So if it happens in a minute, then there's vicarious liability, but if it takes an hour and a quarter, there isn't.
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't draw the line at that, but certainly in the facts presented in this case, there's no argument that what the trooper was doing at the time of the sexual assault furthered the interest of the state.
And nor is there any argument, or was there any, at least any tenable argument, that you know, what the employee did in Draper furthered the interest of his employer. The only difference is that it may have happened, the tort may have occurred at relative warp speed in Draper compared to what happened here.
Well, I also just would note in Draper the idea that someone who's charged with using force to protect the employer's site and maybe uses too much force, that's a different case than this case where someone's charged with jobs at a police authority and then goes and commits a rape and lets the person go. They did the exact opposite of what they're supposed to do.
That's a valid line of distinction, and I suppose that if we were to take the facts in Draper and assume that the employee, that is the defendant employee, took a knife or whatever it was he was using and put it up to the throat of the victim but didn't actually cut it but just threatened to do it, that's okay because it was furthering the purpose of the employer.
Well, under the analysis of Draper, I think the court in Draper would have found that was probably wrong conduct, but it was within this short period of time and was an escalation of his job duties as providing security. And I think the court in Draper said that this was a close case and the holding was limited to the unique facts of that case. We think the facts of this case are different.
They're different.
Much different.
Are they different from a legal point of view?
We think the facts are closer to the Sims case, which has been cited by both parties. And the Sims case, it was a case involving a residential counselor who sexually assaulted a young boy. And the trial court said there's absolutely no reason to believe that any employment-related activity was occurring at the time of the sexual assault, even though the counselor was on duty. He was in this residential dorm. By virtue of his employment, he had the authority to go in there. He did all that, basically abused his power, and the trial court said there's no reason to believe that anything related to his employment is occurring while he's sexually assaulting this boy. We believe.
And is Sims, has that been recognized by this court, affirmed or referred to with approval?
I don't know that it's been affirmed. You know, it was a Superior Court case. I don't know if there was an appeal in that case. It's cited by both parties in their briefs.
What would you like us to do? Distinguish Draper or adopt a different test?
You know, I believe the court should adopt Section 707. That's the current restatement. It was enacted in 2006. It would apply to the facts of this case.
That's the restatement third.
Restatement third of agency, Your Honor.
And if we don't do that,
agency or tort?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You say restatement of agency or tort?
Agency, Your Honor.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
So if we are not inclined to do that, and the question is applying Draper, your position is Draper's distinguishable.
I think Draper is distinguishable, Your Honor, and we don't believe that the Draper court found this affirmative defense that's argued by the appellant. The court does not use the term affirmative defense in that opinion. I haven't found any case anywhere that applies Section 228 and uses that as affirmative defense, that element as affirmative defense. We believe that's part of a prima facie case that the plaintiff has to prove.
And in this case, they have to prove that it was expected?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the difficulty with that test, the reason partly why we're arguing for a restatement third is that if we go back, if we stay with the restatement second and we go down this road of whether or not it's expectable or unexpectable, I think in the appellant's brief they make a distinction between expected or expectable. We submit the restatement third is a much simpler test. It's easier to apply. And we don't get into this issue of statistical analysis of the history of the Delaware State Police since 1930 and how many rapes they've had.
I just want to focus you on an argument that Mr. Lyons made, and that is that the Superior Court misinterpreted Draper and used the not unexpectable criterion as a fourth element that the plaintiff would have to prove, whereas, in fact, that was an affirmative defense that can be presented if and once the plaintiff meets the other three criteria. Do you agree with that position? Is that, did Mr. Lyons state the law correctly? That's question number one.
No, we don't believe it's an affirmative defense. We believe it's an element of the claim that the plaintiff must establish.
And if we were to disagree with you and it were an affirmative defense and not an element of the claim, would that change the result in your view?
No, Your Honor, because I believe the trial court found other, not only the unexpectability lacking, but also the other elements in terms of that this was not conduct that was actuated by any purpose to serve the master. That's item C.
Okay, but that would require focusing on the actual tortious conduct rather than the course of conduct of which the tortious conduct was a part.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I can address that issue, if the court, instead of focusing on the individual...
Well, before you do that, one last thing. Been going back and forth, all of us with you, on how do you distinguish Draper. And I glean, although you didn't put it in these terms, that Draper is distinguishable because in Draper, in this case, you had an officer who was duty-bound to protect the public and to uphold the law and was trained to do that. In Draper, we were talking about a layperson, basically, who was not duty-bound to uphold the law, wasn't trained to do that, and therefore could be expected to fly off the handle and do something foolish, like cut the throat of somebody. But it wouldn't be expected of a police officer given that specialized training in those duties. Is that the thrust of what you're saying, or am I going
to... That's our argument, Your Honor. That's our argument. And just to address this issue about whether or not the course of conduct should be defined generally or specifically, as argued by the appellant, if the police officer had done anything at any point prior to this rape that was authorized, then the rape is within the scope. That analysis would basically... would do away with vicarious liability. We would deal with strict liability. Because at some point he would have done something up to that point that was authorized.
Except, that's a valid concern, and we did ask Mr. Lyons about that, and he articulated several things that the police could do in order to take due care that this would not happen in the ordinary course of the arrest of a female. So, that being the case, what is your response? I mean, if you're arguing that there would be strict liability.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, I haven't found any case that adopts strict liability in these situations other than the Mary M. case from California, which has been criticized throughout the country and in California. the idea of allocating risk between the employer and the employee, at least under the third restatement, the third restatement, Section 707, clearly says that the employer is not an absolute insurer for all conduct of the employee. And the rule that would be argued for here would make the employer an absolute insurer.
Is that right, or would it just put this particular employer, you know, given the nature of the duties of the employer and the police officer employees, to take particular care, that is, specific steps to assure, to the extent that's ever possible, that this type of thing would never happen?
You know, then I think we're holding the state and the police, not just the state police, but all police, to an impossible standard. Anytime anything goes wrong, they're going to be 100% liable. And I think that's inconsistent with Section 707 and the comments to 707, that at some point when the employee makes a decision to do something solely for his own purposes, he's no longer acting as an extension of the employer. He's off on his own, and at that point it's unfair to hold the employer absolutely liable for every single thing that he might do. One of the cases that we cited is the Bates case, where a police officer stopped a vehicle. There were four teenagers in the vehicle. He murdered three of them, raped one. It's just a horrible case. And the Eighth Circuit said, we sympathize completely with the victims in this case and their families, but this is clearly a barbarous act, and we can't find under any theory that it's authorized or within the scope of employment. We don't believe that that's something that would be a situation where the police should be held responsible for that, that they can control necessarily what every employee does every minute of the day. The court has no other questions. We ask the court to affirm the judgment of the Superior Court.
Thank you. Mr. Lyons, you used all your time, but if you have something you'd like to say in a minute, the court's happy to let you do that.
I have a question for Mr. Lyons.
Yes, please. And there's no time limit on answering questions within reason.
I understand. Did someone say that?
I have a question for you, yes, Mr. Lyons. On the scope of employment, hypothetically on the issue of scope of employment, I want to see the parameters of that. And looking at it from another angle, if a police officer is involved in an unlawful rape during the course of his duties, and say the victim picks up his pen and in defense stabs him in the eye, is he entitled to workers' compensation?
Is he entitled? I'd say no. Can't be.
Because
there's got to be a reason why it can't be. I'm not a workers' comp lawyer, but there's got to be a reason why he can't.
Well, is that because it's beyond the scope of his employment?
No, I would say it's because it flowed from wrongful behavior, not because it's outside the scope. That's where I would start analyzing it.
Okay. Thank you.
There's a lot I could say, but quite frankly, it would take too long to say it.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement, and we'll adjourn.
Thank you.